IPVanish protects every device you own, your phone, your laptop, your smart TV. If it connects to the internet, it should be protected. IPVanish encrypts your connection and masks your IP address, helping keep your browsing private at home and on public Wi-Fi. And with no device limits, one account covers everything. Stream with added privacy. Browse securely. Connect with confidence. Right now, save 83% off the 2-year plan. Get started today at ipvanish.com/audio and take control of your privacy with IPVanish.
You're listening to the world's smartest podcast network.
When I go to Sacramento, I will pump up Sacramento. Sacramento.
Some say the news is fake. Others say it's real. These two don't have the time to check. Instead, Turner Sparks and Michael Ira Kaplan turn to comics stationed around the globe to be their eyewitness reporters so that you can know what's really going on. This is Lost in America.
All right, everybody, welcome to Lost in America. My name's Turner Sparks.
And I'm Mike Kaplan.
You can find me on the road tomorrow night, September 30th, in San Antonio, Texas, at Dominion Country Club. Come on out, folks.
The Alamo.
And then the next day, I believe that's October. Yeah, I might hit the Alamo tomorrow. October 1st, I will be in Dallas, Texas, Royal Oaks Country Club. After that, next, I'm going to North Carolina, right around Charlotte. Then after that, I'm doing a week in Vegas, October 18th to 24th, with Mr. Tom Rhodes. You know him from
Mr. Rhodes
on NBC in 1994, I believe. And a great stand-up comedian, tours around the world. And then other dates, November 10th, Sacramento Punchline, Sacramento, California, December 3rd and 4th, Alameda Comedy Club in Oakland, California, hitting the Bay Area. And Andrew Wiggins will probably be at the show because he's not vaccinated, so he can't play for the Warriors.
But they won't let him in the show either.
That's true. Yeah, he won't even be able to come into the show. That's all my... Oh, and then a bunch of country clubs in between. I'm going to Oregon. I'm going all over the place. Go to turnersparks.com for tickets. For Kaplan, you can find him, Cap'n America, on all social media platforms. Is there anything I'm missing here, Cap? Are you coaching soccer? Should I promote your soccer games?
No, at the moment, my son is actually holding out. Because we're not agreeing to this practice schedule.
Oh yes, so he's doing a Ben Simmons.
As we talk about on Live from the Bunker on their Patreon show, we've discussed.
Yes,
he has not played a game yet. He has not attended a practice. He refuses to meet with the team. Refuses to meet with the other with the coaches. He's waiting to be traded. So in the meantime, I'm not working
because you're not okay. So you're
I'm not working.
You're not working. You're the dad of the player. So you're like, yeah, like those players' dads of super, like Lonzo Ball. Lonzo Ball's dad. What's his
I'm
name?
Lamar Ball of soccer.
Something. Yes.
And I can't get a job
today,
by the
Kaplan,
way because. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
On the podcast today, we are talking about Afghanistan. We have Pete Stegemeyer on the show, Kaplan. Now let's explain what happened here. Okay.
Yes.
Pete's gonna be up in a minute and. Usually we do these all live. The guests would be here with us right now. What happened is we recorded this on Monday with the idea of putting it out on Tuesday. Pete was with us, and then not our fault, Riverside FM, this company that we pay buku bucks to do the great, oh my God, it's the best sound, it's the best recording you've ever had in your life. They lost our file. They lost our recording file.
They lost, yeah, they're the new enemies of the pod. Let's be honest.
New enemies of the pod. They are giving us a free month of Riverside FM.
They're the heroes of the pod.
I had to go back in. I spent the last 24 hours of my life saving the audio, fixing it up as much as possible. But we said, Cap, we're going to redo this intro. So it's just me and you. We've already recorded this pod a couple days ago. It's just me and you here right now. And then in a minute, we're going to go to the podcast we recorded a couple days ago. And you will hear that the audio is not perfect. But I'm going to tell you, I did all the work I could on it. And it's as best as it could possibly sound. It's my years, 5 years now. Of audio editing skills put to work, and I think I fixed it up as much as I could. There is a little bit of delay with Kaplan's sound, so you're gonna hear parts where Kaplan makes a joke or Kaplan says something, and me and Pete just flat ignore him.
Like the kid, you're explaining it to me off air of what it sounds like, and it sounds like I'm like the like when Teddy is trying like a grown up conversation. You guys are the grown ups. You're having a conversation. I'm trying to get your attention by making dumb jokes and throwing food. And
you're the child making dumb jokes, and we're just looking, rolling our eyes at you, and ignoring you. That's how it sounds like. That wasn't actually happening. What happened is we couldn't hear you, and you were on like a 5-second delay, yeah. Which is 5 seconds is a lot of time when these conversations are moving fast. I mean, if you get it, you throw out a joke and it hits us 5 seconds later, we don't even know what you're talking about anymore.
It's like the speed of sound. A joke has to move. Which is the one that's faster? Speed of light.
But a joke has to move faster than sound. Yes.
Yeah. If it's like
I think an even better correlation here, what do you call an analogy, is you're like the bad kid in the back of the classroom who's yelling out jokes, and the teacher, by the time that gets to the teacher, they've already moved on. They're trying to just teach math and get it
right. Like, I'm slow. Like, I'm a class clown, but I'm a slow-witted one. So, like, I'm not even making a joke at the right moment. It's like like the jerk store call. Like, I'm thinking of the joke.
Yes. Yeah. Which is by the time you get it out, everyone's moved on. So, I will also say that only lasts about 5 minutes, and then somehow the audio caught up, and then you're in sync with everybody else.
I mean, the shame of it is that I did notice, there's one example early on, and I noticed it happening in the moment. And I was like, there's no way that I wouldn't get even a reaction. They didn't hear me. So I was like trying. I knew there was some sort of delay. So I was holding back a little this episode. He's also a great guest. I didn't want to get in the way. But there were some jokes I thought of to do with Myrna Sparks and all the money she raises just for the Taliban. I had some zingers coming, but I just didn't think I could get them in.
Well, I think we got to that part. I think we did get that in there. But the one thing that everyone should listen out for, just so we can all get a good chuckle, is when Kaplan tries to make a joke about drone strikes. And first of all, it's an off-color joke to make to a former military veteran. But then second of all, what hurts it even more is he and I don't put you over, to use wrestling terms. We no-sell your joke. And it's in reality, it's because we didn't hear it, but it sounds like we just hate the joke and we're like moving on with our lives. So anyway. No,
there are, yeah, well, this is what happens. It's part of the business we've chosen. You know, this is part of the price of the pandemic. If we were in studio, this wouldn't have happened.
This is how it works.
One day.
So Pete's going to be up in a minute. Before him, Kaplan, if you like this podcast, patreon.com/lostinamerica. We are up to $393 a month is what we're at right now. We have said if we hit $400 a month, we are throwing a party at the Friars Club in New York City, and all of our Patreon subscribers are invited. So for $7, or why don't you just throw in $10, you get to be the one who puts us over the top.
Put us over the event. Put us across the finish line. You're going to be the hero.
Across the finish line, and everyone wants to be the fourth leg in the relay race because you're the one who crosses the line to win gold. No one, but you know, our Sugar Brady's, Dennis Owens, Weatherman Keefe, these people are first, second, third legs. Drew Fralick's, Abe Schmitz. Everyone loves Abe Schmidt. Gary Sparks. These are all the early legs. They don't get any of the glory. You're going to be the one to get the glory. Okay.
We will make a toast, a special toast to you at the party, the annual party we're going to throw at the Friars Club. Yes. We will make a toast to the person who gets us over the $400.
And you'll be there because you're going to fly in and have this party with us. And for $10 a month, you're also going to get a Lost in America number one t-shirt. In Armenia t-shirt.
Yeah.
So that's not bad. And can I tell you, Drew Fralick wrote in something today he thinks we should add. He said on our show, Live from the Bunker, which is our, you know, that's our, we're podcasters is what we are. You know, they say someone's a comedian's comedian. We're the real podcasters.
Podcasters.
If you're a true fan of us, you're listening to Live from the Bunker. And a lot of our bunker babes over there, they barely even hear this show. They're so obsessed with the bunker show.
Yeah.
And what we start every one of those shows out with is from my bunker to, no, we start out with, I'm in my bunker, Cap's in his bunker, you are in your bunkers, America. And Drew Fralick said he thinks for the highest money subscriber that month, they should get to send us audio or do it live with us once they get to do the intro.
Oh, I like that idea.
So right now, Sugar Brady is giving us $32.69 a month.
Heads in the toilet.
And he wants... So Drew thinks Sugar Brady this month, one time, he should be able to jump on and say from my bunker to your bunker to Tourist Sparks to Kaplan's bunker. I think that's a great idea.
And it should be the end of the month. So it's like you find out September 30th, like 11:59, if you want to go in, jump in with $33 or whatever is the highest number at the moment. You can be the guy.
And you can do whatever. You can read your own ad live at the very beginning, Cap. So that's a shout out to him. Shout out to Bill, the author, William R. Dodson, a.k.a. Bill Dodson, who went up to $20 a month this week, and he's getting an ad on today's pod. Everybody, thanks for joining in. Now, Cap, Let's skip this whole what do we know about Afghanistan, what do we not know, because we've already done the episode, so it'd because be disingenuous.
It would be disingenuous, although I bet you we don't know. We've already forgotten. That was 2 days ago. So I'll just say one thing. We were doing the episode, and Afghanistan was in the news so much a few weeks ago, and I was realizing how stupid I am, because there was so much that I had read about Afghanistan or been watching. Like, I felt like I knew so much that I'd already forgotten in the 3 weeks.
I've
killed a lot of brain cells over the years.
Well, what we're talking to him about, just to give it quick, is we don't want to get into this idea of like, oh, should we have left? When should we have left? Why didn't we leave at this time? When did we leave too early, too late? What we're trying to figure out is why the Afghan military fell in 2 days.
Why are they
and
so
the
prepared?
Reason why we have this guest comedian, New York City comedian Pete Stegemeyer, is because he's done two tours of duty in Afghanistan working directly with the Afghan military. So he's going to tell us how they were trained, if they were trained, what they were trained. Like, were they good? Were they bad? And we let him tell the tale. We're not here to say, we're not here to prove a point that we've already come up with.
Yeah,
we're,
it's not like our
maybe they
narrative.
Were great. Maybe they were great. Maybe it was our fault. Maybe they were terrible. Maybe it was their fault. We're going to find out. Cap, should we go to the interview?
Play the music. Or go
well,
to the interview.
No music, but just, we'll play the swoosh sound.
Play the sound.
Let's get to Pete Stegemeyer is a comedian in New York City, award-winning comedian, writer, physical and cybersecurity expert, which I want to get to. Physical security expert sounds very cool to me. And he also has a book. He's also an author. He has a book coming out called Heist. It hit stores in October. So check that out. And he served. Oh, this is the most important part why we have him on. He served twice in the he served in the U.S. military.
That's
was
the key,
deployed
twice
to Afghanistan and worked with the Afghan troops. Yeah. Pete, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much.
Thanks for doing it, man. Where did we? I don't even know. Where should we? Yeah, we don't know much. You worked with the. Well, can we? What year, yeah, let's start with what years did you work with the Afghan military?
Yeah, so I did. My first deployment was from June of 08 to June of 09.
Okay.
And then pretty much all of 2011.
Wow.
And so those were two different deployments to different areas of Afghanistan, but still working hand in hand with the Afghan army and the Afghan police both times.
Okay. And what was your... Going over there, what was your job? What was your assignment?
I was an infantryman. So on the first deployment, especially, I was our platoon's radio telephone operator. So basically any of the big meetings, I would sit there like with my lieutenant and kind of, you know, meet all the village elders, kind of help with, like, you know, the execution of patrols and things like that. And then the second deployment, I was a team leader. But I also did a lot of the administrative paperwork and like the higher level stuff.
Okay. And when you say the elders of the, what'd you say, the elders of the community?
Yes.
What does that mean?
So basically each village would have specific or have a variety of elders. So there would be religious leaders like mullahs. There would be some people that were just, you know, had been in the community for years and were kind of the people that would sign off on everything and provide that leadership. And so we would go to them to kind of assess like their needs and be like, okay, like how can we like make life more stable for you? Like what things can we provide? And also, you know, can you tell us where the Taliban are?
And what, so that, let's get to that question right away. So the Taliban was there the whole time?
Oh yeah, they were everywhere.
was part of the US mission to get rid of the Taliban, or do we kind of move past that? Or was that never part of the mission?
I think originally it was part of the mission, and then we realized, kind of like we did in Vietnam, that like you can't like it's really, really hard to defeat an insurgency, especially when they're not wearing, you know, uniforms, and they can just, you know, just not shoot at you, and then you don't know that they're Taliban at that time. So it's like it's very easy for them to integrate like back into the community, lay low for a bit, and then come back when things are good. But then like they would also come out at night. Like if we would, after we would leave patrols, they would like ride in on like their like dirt bikes or scooters or whatever, and they would go to the same people that we talked to and say, what did you tell the Americans? Like, if you cooperate, we're gonna, you know, whatever the threat happened to be. And so it kind of quickly turned from being a kinetic, like conventional war where we would, you know, just have shootouts to almost for a bit, kind of like a killing with kindness campaign where we were trying to win the hearts and minds, because that was like ideologically was the only way to defeat them. And so we would like build a school and say, this was built, you know, by the ISAF treaty forces or by NATO. And then they would go and like fix a road and put a sign up that said like, this stretch of highway has been adopted by the Taliban. And
I thought it was bad that Trump adopted a highway up in Westchester here in New York.
Yeah. Wow, so there were like weird things like that, but then there was still like the conventional fighting. And so at that point it became like pretty clear that any sort of victory was going to take generations of like education and things like that. And then we would build schools and then they would burn the schools down, or they would, you know, go and attack all the children going to school. So nobody was going to school and nobody was getting that education. Jeez. And basically just, yeah, it just like, you can't really win a conventional war like that.
Yeah. So it was just this never ending loop of we do this, they do that, we do this. Did they ever have, like a centralized command, the Taliban?
Yeah, they definitely do. They have leaders. At the time, I believe Mullah Omar was kind of their principal head. But the person at the top would typically not have a long life expectancy. Like, so they might, you know, serve as the leader for a couple of years, but then somebody else would take it up. But then they started branching out into political arms. And so they had like a full-blown political party that had like people who were highly educated and like lifelong politicians. There was also, you know, insane amounts of corruption throughout the Afghan government, but also every other government that's ever existed. And so it became, it was like whack-a-mole combined with the shell game.
Yeah. So when they didn't have, the leaders didn't have a long life expectancy because they would be a target for we would go kill them, or because their own Taliban would kill them?
Typically because we were, executing either like special forces raids. If we like thought we could take them alive, there were a lot of drone strikes and things like that as well.
So you really don't want to be the head of the Taliban. I mean, now you might, but not back then.
Well, it's a prestige position.
You really didn't want, like, it was kind of like, you know, that like game that they would play in like Aztec Mexico where they like with the hoop, and it was like the winning team would get sacrificed. Like, you really want to be the second best guy at that game.
Right.
Yeah.
Second guy. Like, second command at all times. Yeah, always the right hand
like,
man. Never
enough to like make it look like you're given at the old college try, but like just always banked a little left. Like that's kind of the guy you'd want to be.
Wow. And what, were they ever coming and trying to kill? I guess they were. Were they waging attacks on our military?
Oh yeah, they would. Yeah. They would do a lot of typically IEDs. Seem to be like the primary, because, like, again, like there's just, you can't beat us in an open field of combat. Like, that's just not going to happen. But they were really good at IEDs, like suicide bombers, things like that. But then they were also they were really strategic with things like rocket attacks and mortars, because those you could like some of them you could set like a cake timer, and when the timer went off, it would like connect the wires and the rocket would shoot off or whatever. But they also knew our rules of engagement very well. So like, for example, if they were standing next to a building, they could lob mortars at us and we couldn't fire back because we couldn't risk damaging the building. So they would just kind of like camp out there and like lob mortars at us until they ran out, and we really couldn't do much about that.
So was that, you mean a building, like maybe like a hospital or a school or something like that?
I mean, sometimes, but usually it was just like mud huts and things like that.
Our rules of engagement is that we wouldn't take down a mud hut.
Yeah. Because typically like families live there.
I see. Yeah.
And so it was,
We would only take them with a drone.
And even then, like, they would have to, like, you'd have to have eyes on them as they, like, rode away on, like, their dirt bikes. And then if they were, like, sufficiently away from everything else, then you could execute a drone strike. But if they were, like, in a community, like, we really, because collateral damage at that point, too, would have been devastating to our Hearts and Minds campaign.
Yeah. So, okay. So that's the enemy. And now you're training. Were you doing training or working along with, how'd you work with the Afghan military?
So we had a lot of, like, partnership with the Afghan military. Typically there was the ANA, which is the Afghan National Army. And then there was the ANP, which was the Afghan National Police. And the police typically stuck to the cities, and would kind of work because individual towns didn't have, like, their own, like, deputized sheriffs. It was all national police. But the Afghan army and then sometimes the Afghan police would go on patrols with us. Like, we would bring them on, like, combat missions with us so that they could kind of, like, work with our teams and have a good understanding, because the Afghan army was built on a model, not surprisingly, because we built it to resemble the American army. And so, like, getting their infantrymen to, like, work with ours was a big part of that. But then there was also, like, the support element, and that's, I think, where everything ultimately failed.
Okay. So what happened? What was the support element?
So a good example, like, something that, like, the recruiters say a lot, like, when you join, like, the American Army, is that there's 212 jobs in the military. But infantry is only one of those jobs. The rest are support of some sort. So you have, like, cooks, you have truck drivers, you have the people that, like, fuel up helicopters, you have the people that pilot the helicopters, load the weapons, all of that stuff.
Like, you have the band, right?
Yeah, you have,
it's like a trumpet player and stuff.
Exactly. And so, and we can't really do anything like without that support network. And so that was the way that the Afghan army was built as well. But because that, if the infantry is the tip of the iceberg, like, the rest of, like, the support pile is so much bigger, and there just wasn't personnel to make a sufficiently large thing. So we subcontracted almost all of that. And this is like, if I'm throwing on the tinfoil hat, like, this was making billions for defense contractors, because they were the ones providing those services for.
Sure.
The NA. So, like, they were the ones maintaining their helicopters. They were the ones, you know, doing, like, pretty much everything. And so when.
So these are companies like, is Halliburton still around? Like, companies, yeah, like American defense contractor companies?
Yeah, it's all in American defense contractors. Halliburton, Raytheon, like, Kellogg, Brown and Root was the one that Dick Cheney was involved with, as well, yeah, as Halliburton. And all of these companies were providing the lifeblood of the Afghan army. And so when the drawdown happened that abruptly, all those contractors got pulled out, and then the Afghan army's capabilities got diminished. Like it wasn't that they just, like, stopped fighting. It was that they were stranded and they couldn't do anything. They couldn't call for air support. They couldn't call for anything. And it was basically, you know, if we fight, we die. If we don't, then maybe they'll absorb us into, like, the Taliban army. Like, that's our best case scenario. So, and then also, like, the president, like, took a huge bribe and fled the country with, like, $160 million before the drawdown. So I'm pretty certain that he told them not to fight as well, and just kind of took off.
Whoa. Wait a second. Wow. So
we forgot to mention that in the intro, but when the Afghani president left, I knew.
Yeah, I should have said that too. You're right. That was when he left. That was obviously, if your number one leader leaves the country, then you're going to be like, screw this. But I haven't heard anything about this. That makes so much sense. This idea of the iceberg and the tip of the iceberg. So you're saying that our military is basically built ground up. It's built from all these people who support the infantry and all those. Why did we not build their military that way? You said there wasn't enough people? There weren't enough Afghans?
I think it's a couple things. And if I'm going to be, like, really skeptical, I think a lot of it was because it made a lot of people a lot of money to not have that go,
yes,
locally. The idea, I mean, I think that's why we never declared war against Afghanistan. We declared war against fear, terror, as like an abject, like persistent enemy, so you can justify having a forever war. And so I think that was a big part of it. And then eventually people were like, we have to go. And there was just no clean way to do that. But we didn't give the Afghan people a chance, because when Trump negotiated the drawdown calendar with the Taliban, they had those meetings with Taliban leadership. They didn't have those meetings with Afghan government leadership. So the Afghan government wasn't in on the loop. Like, they were never part of it. Like, we never, basically never considered them a viable government if we're not negotiating our release with them instead of the Taliban.
Wow. Okay. And what was the Afghan government like in terms of what did the people see? Because I guess the military supports the government, right? And how did the people view the Afghan government? You'd mentioned corruption. Were there free elections? Did people feel like these are actually our leaders, or how did that work?
So that's another like $1 trillion question. Because like we would do things in support of free elections. Like, we would pull security on like district centers for them to hold like local government, gubernatorial, like races and things like that. But I mean, it's really hard to tell, because a lot of times the candidates like knew they were risking their lives. So it's hard to get candidates to want to run for things a lot of times, or to, you know, formally announce and say, like, these are the things I'm going to do, because that would draw ire from the Taliban. I think a lot of people realized that the government was pretty corrupt, but at the same time, the Afghan people didn't really have a dependence on government like we did, or at least a form of government like ours. And so when we were trying to say, oh, you have to like vote for these guys, and then they'll like be in charge, like, we don't want that. We want like local, like tribal leadership.
Right. They didn't used to have, they never had, right? Before we went in, they didn't have a strong national.
Yeah. And like what they had, like the, probably the closest that they had, I mean, it's been, the British were there 100 years ago. I really think like since the Soviets came, like everything has been like, you just have to leave them alone. Because like after the British left, like Kabul in the 70s, if you ever see like photos of it, was a pretty modern Western style city. Like, there were women in like short skirts, you know, working like professionally and things like that. And then things kind of went to hell when the Soviets invaded. They pushed back on that a little bit, but that allowed, partly because, you know, we funded the Taliban and the Mujahideen to kind of take over. And things haven't been like that for, you know, 50 years now.
I mean, in the 80s, the Taliban was going to like suburban potlucks in America and raising money. My parents donated money in the 80s to the Taliban, and all their friends did.
It wasn't actually called the Taliban, in fairness to them.
Yeah. Rambo 2 was dedicated to the Taliban. I mean, it's insane. And my parents were like, no, it was like Stan Atkinson was the local news. Like, you know how in the 80s we all had a local news reporter who was like the Walter Cronkite, but for your city? He was the local guy in Sacramento, California, and he was going hand in hand with the Taliban. They had a big funk. They had $100 a plate dinner at the Radisson downtown. And all the, if you were anybody who was anybody in Sacramento, California, you donated to the Taliban in the 80s. And they were doing this in every city in America, Cleveland, Detroit, you know, Philadelphia, wherever. And then that was all to fight the Russians, basically. So,
yeah.
Well, they weren't the Taliban, in fairness. They were called.
What were they called?
They were the Mujahideen, but that basically became the structure of the Taliban.
Grassroots. Yeah.
Well,
so
good job to all of them. So when the Russians went in, did they try to set up? Did we learn anything from them?
I mean, I feel like the lesson we should have learned was you can't take over Afghanistan like that.
Real basic one.
And we kind of knew that like going in. We're like, well, like nobody has ever like nobody has ever like conquered Afghanistan. Like the closest person, probably Alexander the Great. And that's like, yeah, Kandahar was named after him and became like the central seat of his like western or eastern push. But even he didn't get all of it. Like it was, and also that was, you know, thousands of years ago. So things have changed a bit. But they're just, you can't force them to, you can't force them to adopt a form of governance that they don't want for themselves.
Yeah, if they have these like local tribal leaders, then that's what they kind of want, right? Maybe they don't need this style. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just like, I mean, we just have to leave well enough alone. And like, I think there still needs to be like, you know, monitoring of the Taliban and things like that. But at the same time, like they're extremely resilient people. They've fought back every invader that has ever come to Afghanistan. And we kind of have to trust them to be able to do that to themselves as much as possible. It's hard though, because like it seemed important to like protect like the women and children, because you'd see all this like horrible stuff going on, and that
sure.
Like as you were like building the schools and stuff like that. Like I was in Afghanistan when Malala got shot in Pakistan, and we're like, this is like the kind of stuff that we have to like, you know, like stop. And so it becomes, yeah, it become, but after a while it kind of felt like it was more about our ability to like us being able to say, oh, we could do whatever, than it was about like actually helping the people. And I think it almost became kind of like narcissistic, like, well, the Americans can do this, like, well, we'll be great with that. And we weren't equipped, and they didn't want what we were offering.
How were the women and children, how were they treated? Like, what did you see while you were there?
I mean, so there were a lot of, like most, pretty much every woman was wearing the burqas while we were there. And we didn't interact with them very often because there were like pretty strict cultural rules with like only women should talk to women and things like that. We didn't have a lot of times we didn't have a woman like in our infantry platoon or whatever. So we would try to sit with like the interpreter sometimes, but they were sometimes not open to that. The children were cool. And the women that we got to talk to a little bit are obviously, I mean, it felt very human because they're like we know this sucks. Like we know that like our kid, like kids don't have like the brightest future and things like that. And like, they were aware of that, but they also were kind of aware, like, I don't know like how to do this. So we would try to do things, like just like even like small things, like we would like hand out like mittens and stuff like that, like during the winter. And they seemed like very appreciative. Like, I mean, I guess like at the end of the day, like everybody's human, and like there's like certain shared human experiences. It's like, okay, these people really want to take care of our kids versus, you know, whatever. And I think that was a big part of it. But yeah, we didn't interact like as much as we did with the men, just because of the cultural,
differences. Even because I guess what we've read on the news is like, oh, Afghanistan a month ago or 2 months ago was this open and free society, and then the Taliban came in, and now women have no rights, and women and children don't have rights, or whatever it might be. So how accurate is that? Was the shift? Do you think the shift would have been that gigantic, or does it?
And also because of the Taliban was always around, so they had to be incremental. They would go to school, but you still.
So that, I feel like a lot of that stuff happened before I got there, because when we arrived in 2008, like girls were not allowed to go to school already. And everybody was supposed to wear the burqas. Like
girls were not allowed to go to school in 2008.
Correct.
While the U.S. military was there.
Yeah. And then we would like,
is it because of the region?
Well, like, that was basically what the Taliban had laid down as law. And so we would build schools and try to encourage, you know, and like pull security. So it's like, hey, boys and girls can go to this school. But then there were like religious things with it. And it became, but the Taliban was always watching. So if like women did go or girls did go to school, then there would be notes like, you know, hammered in the public square. That's like, we saw your girls go to school. If it happens again, everybody dies.
Oh my gosh. They didn't tell us that. They told us that from like 2001 to 2020, like everybody could go to school. Everyone was happy. Like women wore makeup.
I saw girls skateboarding.
They listen to rock music, and then we leave, and then it all. Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, and like I was pretty remote parts of Afghanistan. Like, it might have been a little bit different in Kabul because there were like way more coalition forces, and you know, cities. Yeah, and cities tend to be more. I think like more liberal leaning in that kind of way, anyways. But yeah, that was a pretty common thing. Like it.
The liberal
they didn't really have a lot of weren't like many good things going for them at that point as well, and that kind of happened a little bit slowly, but as like the Taliban started grabbing power, the kind of like a snowball where it was like, okay, like now like we're in control of this, like now we control agriculture, so everybody is going to grow poppy for us or you're going to die, so that they could produce opium.
Really?
Yeah, and so a lot of farmers were prevented from growing like food crops because.
And this was happening in like 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12.
Oh yeah, this was happening all over.
We did the surge. What year was the surge? Remember, we did a surge there. Is it 2011 when you were there the second time?
I think there were a couple surges because I think 2011 was part of the surge because at that point, like Iraq had pretty much ended, so all the troops that had been there were kind of moved over.
So they were growing. Poppy to make heroin, I guess, right?
Correct.
While we were there, Kaplan, did you know any of this? Really?
Yeah, I knew that. I mean, I thought it wasn't for poppy bagels, unfortunately.
No, but I mean, Sorry.
No, I was going to say that's one of the reasons I would always hear about all this corruption was that they were just turning around, and then we would try to would we try to burn down a field, but then, you know, it's like a. Then the Taliban would punish them. You know, like there was no right way to do this, right? There's no, like, that's the economy. That's what they make.
Yeah,
that's how they make their money.
I guess I'm going to get a little conspiratorial here, but I find it pretty damning that, like, the entire time that we're in Afghanistan, where they're the largest producer of opium probably on the planet, the United States is having a hell of an opioid crisis. And then in the 80s, when we were in, Central and South America, discreetly, that's when like cocaine becomes a huge thing. Like it's not a coincidence that like we're going to all these like drug cash cow places and then seeing those same drugs from that region that should be getting burned, ending up all over the world and destroyed.
They're not making any drugs in North Korea, Kaplan. That's why we're not there.
That's
why we're never got Korea.
That's why we don't go in.
Yeah. North Korea is the best.
Go ahead, Pete.
I was going to say, North Korea, like they fund pretty much all their operations because of sanctions due to crimes. So they have like one of the best hacking teams in the world. They also make incredible amounts of meth because like they're a nation state and they can buy, like they can go full Walter White and buy stuff that like ordinary people wouldn't be able to buy. And then they just, it's easier to sell meth than.
Do they go to the Home Depot and buy all the products too, like Walter White does?
I think so. It's just a bunch of giant orange buckets.
Yeah. Well, if we go into North Korea in 2 years and then a year later, there's a meth crisis in America, we'll know why. We got to take a break real quick. So Kaplan, and when we get back, I want to get into ghost troops and a bunch of stuff. I want to go deep. Yeah, we got to get into the corruption and the follow the money type stuff. But more than we even have so far. But Kaplan, we have for $20 a month for our Patreon subscribers, you get one ad a month on this show. A $20 ad. You can't beat that. When we get the big companies, we charge them millions. But for our listeners, it's only $20. And this week we have the great author, William R. Dodson. Excuse me. I know him as Bill Dodson because we're friends and I'm in Hollywood.
Yeah. William to me.
So we're chums, but he's William R. Dodson. He has a great book out called Virtually International. He's done multiple. He's an author. This is his third book. I got to interview him for his first book when we were both living in China about about the emerging market of business in China. That was like a decade ago. And now I just did a book talk with him about his new book, Virtually International. We did it virtually because that's what it's about. This new world of working with teams. If you're a manager at a company and you have teams around the world, you have to read this book, because Bill's lived around the world. He's lived in Turkey, China, all over the place. He knows a bunch about the different cultures. And in this book, he walks you through how to successfully work with a team around the world. There's simple stuff, Kaplan. Bill and I talked about this. I remember when we were living out in China and we had to work, either one of us with our businesses had to work with Americans. The Americans would always be like, all right, we're doing it at noon. And noon Friday is the meeting, not caring that is midnight for you on Friday night. And so, you know, you're not going to stop me from partying. So I'd go out to the Drunken Clam, get hammered, and then come back and do a drunk meeting at midnight. But if you really want your team to work better, figure out what time zone they're in, what one you're in. I mean, it's basics that people. And I asked Bill about that, and he said, oh, that's a common refrain of people around the world. They said when they work with Americans, the Americans always schedule it on their time. And then everybody else. So if you're in Turkey, you got to get up at 3 a.m. because they want to have an 11 a.m. breakfast meeting or something. So there's a million tips in there. Plus, he has great stories about working in China with drunk government leaders. And you have to.
A lot of drinking stories.
It's a lot of drinking stories in Turkey, drinking in India. He has some crazy stories. So go check it. Everybody, Virtually International. We will put the link.
If you want to. I was going to say, if you want to run a meth business out of North Korea or anywhere else and you need advice on internet.
That'll be in the second edition.
To do it, this is the book.
that's the addendum. You know, like you when your teacher makes you buy in college, they make you buy the.
When the paperback.
Yeah, there you go.
A little addendum.
Virtually International. That's it. William R. Dodson. And now, Kaplan, a word from our local sponsor. All right, we're back. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sponsor.
Thanks to all the local sponsors. We love you. We see you. We know who you are. Pete's.
Quality products and services.
They're great. They really are the best. I think it's almost ski. They know we have a wide audience, so they really promote skiing on our show. Well, there's always ads for skiing, so I'm sure those are coming up.
There's a lot of ads for Vermont skiing, which is very triggering.
That's for you. These are local sponsors. In Northern California, I've been told they're Tahoe ski ads. And in Colorado, it's Vail and all these places. So, Pete, so speaking of money and how this all worked with the Afghan military, how did it work? Did the U.S. give them a budget and then they went out and spent it on their own military? Or how did that flow? Do you know?
So I can speak to that a little bit, like, because I was just an infantryman.
Yeah, based off of what you know.
But my understanding of it was basically not so much that they could order like what they wanted. It was basically, we just gave them a bunch of our stuff. And so we would, a lot of times, like they would prefer, they would actually prefer like the AK-47s to our M4s. But like a lot of the trucks and stuff like that, we would give them money for, or for like the advanced systems, like, you know, Javelin, rocket launchers and things like that, we would just give that to them. So as far as I am aware, there wasn't like a lot of like requisition and them saying like, we could really use a bunch of this. It was, here's all this stuff.
And you're saying we gave them stuff, as far as you know, as opposed to money, as opposed to a blank check, it would be an actual thing.
Well, I think there was also a lot of like, we had like pallets or like entire shipping containers full of cash. And
whoa, cash?
About that.
Yeah, and a lot of times like that would go towards, like, you know, trying to buy crops or trying to, you know, jumpstart local businesses, things like that. Sorry about that. My dog's stuck in my wires because...
Oh, no problem.
We would just like hand a pallet to like a local tribal leader and say like, divide this up.
What we would do is we wouldn't give them like the pallet. We would just hand them like stacks off of it and say like, you get this much.
Stacks of cash.
Oh yeah.
What?
There were like basically banks on American bases that were just full of cash rooms and things like that. And then some of that would be used, you know.
And would they have to return an itemized receipt to us of how they spent the cash?
Like billions, if not trillions, just disappeared. Same in Iraq.
Oh my gosh.
No, I was just saying that I read that an estimate had it as high as a third of all the money that we spent over there just sort of disappeared.
Oh, 100%.
We don't even know where it went.
100%. Like the accountability stuff, which is
billions.
Just like didn't apply on a large scale.
And who would we, when we would hand out this money, we would hand it out to the Afghan president, like actual government leaders or these tribal town leaders?
Little column A, little column B. So like we would have teams like we, as a like forwardly deployed like infantry company, we didn't really have access to the cash, but if like civil affairs came in, they would have access to cash. Like there were people whose whole job was to, you know, go to city leaders and say, oh, you need $25,000 to build a well. Cool, here you go. And then the impetus was supposed to be, you know, that they would go out and hire somebody to build the well. And it was supposed to, you know, A, help build an infrastructure, B, create jobs and things like that. But a lot of times that $25,000 well, like they would come back and be like, they need $75,000 for it. And so things would just disappear like that. Like we would spend a lot of money trying to incentivize information, which is basically just bribing.
Yeah.
To say like, you know, who's seen who. It's just, and it's all cash. So it's really not traceable.
Why do all cash? We're banking. Was the banking system not developed there?
It'll take
cash is always king. I think,
yeah, but
a lot of like there weren't like a lot of these areas and stuff like that. Like there were no ATMs. Like there were no nobody had debit cards. Like cash. It was basically cash or barter system.
And Square.
And what cash? It was U.S. dollars? Is Afghan money?
So you would see like a couple different kinds of cash. Like you would see Afghan money a lot. But you would also see U.S. dollars. You would see Iranian money sometimes. We would like, if we detained like Taliban guys, like sometimes they would have like, you know, thousands of dollars Iranian on them.
Really?
Which ended up like not being very much. Like for a while I had like a 50,000, like a 50,000 Iranian dollar bill. I think it was worth like $20.
Nice.
Did they try to bribe you with that or something?
On somebody.
And is that because Iran just had a more stable currency, or were these people working with Iranians?
So that's where it gets to be like pretty crazy. I think for a bit, like there was certainly, especially my first deployment, we were in Kandahar province, but then there was Helmand province, which was like one of the big Taliban strongholds that I believe was like on or very close to the Iranian border. I think it was on the Iranian border. So there would be like some movement between them. But then the Taliban also hired a bunch of mercenaries and things like that. And it benefited Iran to kind of have, you know, things going on in Afghanistan and Iraq, because that kind of meant that, you know, the U.S. was preoccupied. Mm. So I feel like there's probably a little bit of collaboration there. But sometimes like when we were doing like battle damage assessments and we would like, you know, find the bodies of people that had died in firefights, like we would find that like instead of that the Taliban was hiring like Chechen mercenaries and like outsourcing some of their fighters.
And where did they get, I'm sorry, I'm going off a little bit here, but where did the Taliban get their funding from? Selling opium or selling?
Yeah, a lot of it was from selling opium and heroin and things like that. But also just the fact that they were like bandit kings. So like they could go like into towns, kind of like the red scarves in Tombstone. They just sometimes would come into town, like take whatever they wanted. And also, I'm pretty sure on a geopolitical level that like countries like Russia or Iran were all but happy to help fund them against us. Because the more I sit and think about it, the more I just feel like Iran or Afghanistan was like more of a proxy war.
Yeah.
Right. Kept us busy.
Yeah.
Kept us out of there.
And what were the ghost troops? Do you know, you're familiar with that term?
Could you explain that real quick?
This is a thing that's come up very recently in the news in the U.S. that there were what I guess the U.S. media is calling ghost troops. You might have called them something else. But it's this idea that they would, on paper, there were 300,000 Afghan troops. And the theory is that in actuality, there was closer to 100,000, but that the Afghan military would say there was 300 because then they say we need uniforms for 300,000. We need like whatever guns. And then they could pocket the 200,000 of those people didn't exist. So they could just pocket that money. But that Biden and all of our presidents throughout as long as this has been going on have been, specifically Biden was basing his exit off of this idea of 300,000, or at least theoretically, well, they have 300,000, so that'll last them. They can beat the blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. This amount of time. Yeah.
Do you know anything about that?
So a little bit. Like anything that I'm going to say on that is speculation, but I 100% believe that because to an extent we did that as well. Like the US Army, like we would pretty constantly, like we would have like readiness numbers. And I was like, okay, like a platoon, for example, is supposed to have 28 people. You know, four teams of like seven people, or depending on the thing, some squads would be like mass. It'd be like maybe say 40 people for a platoon. But a lot of times like platoons would deploy and they'd only have 30 people, but like the numbers and stuff like that, like we would say, oh, we're ready. Like you needed to hit like this threshold of, you know, people to be able to deploy. And so the word would come from top to, you know, say like a couple of those people that can't deploy because of medical conditions, just say they're deployable. And then they kind of figured we can add people like as they get out of basic training, we can ship them to like the units and stuff like that. But we like fudging the numbers like that is definitely done on both sides. And I think that probably happened a lot, especially because like the other thing with like the Afghan army, that I think a lot of people forget is like they were there the whole time. So it's not like our army where, you know, I did 2 years. The people that I worked with in Afghanistan in 2008, like that one on patrols, like they're probably all dead. And like their sons are now in the army, or like basically like they feel like they don't have a choice and they've been fighting for 20 years and people are like, if you made it all the way through, like you're retiring or the Taliban killed you at this point.
Yeah.
And so,
I mean, yeah, they lost like 60,000 troops, right? I mean,
it becomes really hard to like track, like, cause they also don't have the accountability that we have kind of like we had in like World War II, where like you would see movies where like some guy would like find himself like behind enemy lines and then like come like stumble across like another unit and they're like, oh, you're just like, you're part of this unit now. Like, yes. Logistically, that's a nightmare. That would never happen here because they would say like, what unit? And we could like contact people. But like at the time, like that communication like didn't exist, like that identification didn't exist. So people could just leave and either assume they were dead or join another unit. And a lot of these people, like the Afghan army, like they wouldn't, if you like using the US for an example, like I'm in New York, like I'm based up in New York City. You're out of LA, right?
No, we're both in New York, but I'm in Texas right now. I'm doing shows, but we both live in New York.
Okay.
On the road.
So like, yeah, we're in New York. Like say exact same thing happened and giant army came and like we had to like start like a National Guard here or whatever. Like typically we would say, okay, like we're in the New York National Guard now. Like we're going to stay here because we know the area. But in Afghanistan, it was so much more dangerous for them to do that. So they would say like, okay, well, you're going to go fight in Kansas because the Taliban in Kansas isn't going to know who you are and they're not going to like find your families. And that was how we were telling people that we would keep them safe. And that lack of accountability makes things like, you know, ghost troops like that much easier because nobody knows where anybody is.
Yeah.
The Taliban would want us to be fighting for New York because we're pretty useless.
Well, you and I are, Kaplan, not Pete.
At least that's what I meant. Turner and I, not him, obviously. Especially me. But yeah, I can't even squint. But anyway.
And so when you were there, did it feel like, did the Afghan military people you worked with, did they feel like motivated, committed, well-trained on the same level as a U.S. military troop would be?
So I'm going to say yes and no on that. Like their equipment was like definitely lacking. Like they flat out did not have like the same capabilities that we had. Like we owned the night. So like our night vision goggles and stuff like that, like we trained hours to be able to like raid villages in complete darkness and stuff like that. And their training, like we worked a lot with them. But it was kind of weird because it almost felt like they were basic trainees, where a lot of times like they would have like the commanders and we would like say, okay, like, this is how our squad is going to do this. Like, this is like the area, and everybody's kind of learning everything the first time together. And so like, technically they weren't as proficient as us, but like, there were a lot of them that like really gave a shit. And like, some of those guys were maniacs in like the best possible way. Like, we would be like in a firefight and some guy would run up with like the Rambo, like 240 Bravo machine gun with like the belt of ammo in his other hand. You just stand on top of the berm and just like empty the thing.
Jeez. Just spraying it across like back and forth.
Like, and probably not hitting anything. Or like they love to like jump on berms and just shoot rocket launchers. Like they were nuts with stuff like that. Like a lot of them. And like they didn't really give a shit. And I think you had to join the army at all, knowing the risks of not just dying in combat, but your family getting hurt and stuff.
Yeah.
Like that. And so I think it's like really unfair for people to say, oh, they just like laid down their stuff and they didn't care. Like, A, like it's been going on for 20 years, and B, they risked so much more than we did.
Yeah. Cause as you said, you guys were gone after a year or whatever it might be.
You guys were doing the like coaching sort of like telling the strategizing, and they relied on that air support
and
too,
and that
right?
Was the thing, is when we cover when we them. Left and we took all those security contractors back, like that just like we wouldn't have been able, like if it was just infantry units, like we could have fought to the last man, but without like our air support and things like that, we would not have the capabilities to fight the Taliban according to our training and according to our expectations. And I think it would have gone a lot worse than people think, like if you just had like isolated groups of troops like suddenly stuck behind enemy lines.
You mean even if Americans were just fighting the Taliban without air support?
Yeah, I mean, like, there's like documentaries on that. Yeah. Like Restrepo was like a base that got attacked, and it was like a vicious firefight, and they were like surrounded and like pinned down in like the mountains and stuff like that, and it was brutal, and they still had the ability at some points, like during battles like those, to you know call for air support. Like it might not get there right away, but. I think you didn't hear very often of entire camps being overrun, but it was because we had so much greater capabilities.
Yeah. And when did the air support and all the contractors, when did they leave? Do you know?
I believe it started a couple months ago. And that was kind of the thing that...
So the final pullout was August 31st. That was like...
Yeah, I think it started going in like April.
Wow.
And the problem, there were a couple problems with the pullout. Like we never should have told the Taliban, like we never should have given them a time frame.
Sure.
Like that's just.
Even Trump said that.
Because at that point, like best case scenario, they just lay low until like October 1st.
Yeah, they're waiting it out.
Yeah, and because then it's like at what point, like, but. There was also the fact that like, as we started like pulling out, like we should have been getting families of like interpreters and all of the people that worked with us, start, you know, trickling them out for months, like start pulling them out in April instead of like having them do a mad dash at the airport.
Totally.
And like leave the bases, like standing there until it's time. Like the problem with the way that they like started pulling people from the outer bases and things like that. And I got to see three of the bases that I was on. And it was kind of funny, a little funny, like also sad, a little funny. Cause there were like three main bases that I was at during my time in Afghanistan. And there was a CNN report, and the reporter literally named all three in a row and being like, have all fallen to the Taliban. I'm like, son of a bitch.
What were the bases?
So there was FOB Andar, there was FOB Ramrod, and then there was also there was Miri Hatal, which is now Cop Wrath, and then we were at FOB Four Corners. But like all of those were were taken. And then like basically because like stuff didn't get blown up, which I understand, like you can't blow everything up like that.
Yeah.
As much as people like think that's a good idea, like it basically just meant that now the Taliban had these hardened fighting positions. And so after like probably June, when they now controlled most of the bases, and then we closed down Bagram Airfield to consolidate everything in Kabul to completely pull out. Like that was when all our air support was gone. And then they just went nuts because they knew they couldn't be stopped. And they knew that if we were going to stop them in any meaningful way, besides, you know, bombing bases, which probably has a lot of collateral damage, I mean, we'd have to recommit, you know, hundreds of thousands of troops.
So this idea that it all fell in 2 days is just so far off. I mean, first of all, the Taliban was there the whole time. Second of all, it started in June when we gave up all these bases.
Yeah, it probably started before that, honestly.
Yeah.
But that was, and I think that was like the inevitable thing. It was, I don't think there's any way that this could have gone differently. The only thing that I can think that should have been different was all of the Afghan like refugees and things like that should have been the first people to go, like all the interpreters' families and the people, the ANA soldiers, like that. You know, if they fought and they wanted to leave the country, like they should have been able to do that. You know,
yes,
and, yeah. And things like that. And then we should have been able to kind of just, you know, hold off and say, you know, we're going to protect you guys on the way out and then kind of collapse inward so that we could just make a tidier exit. And I'm sure there's some reasons that didn't happen, but that's how I would have done it.
Sure. And when you, you know, when it all fell so quickly, at least the Afghan military and the Afghan government fell in a few days, Biden had said that, well, his team told him it would take 18 months to fall. Is there any, knowing what you know, is there, where would you stand on that? Is there any way you would see them lasting 18 months?
I'm going to say no. I, especially because we clipped their wings. Like,
yeah.
Especially like the contractor thing like that. That devastated them. And I think, yeah, I don't know how they could have made it 18 months. Like maybe they were going off of like the ghost troop numbers and they thought like 300,000.
Yeah.
But
that's one theory. But
at the same time, like, and I'm just being 100% honest, like,
sure.
If this happened here, and we were like red dawning it, and then like all of a sudden, like our biggest ally in the area left, chances are like I'm changing my clothes and I'm getting the fuck out because
yeah.
My only chance of survival is probably get somewhere and act like I don't know what's happening.
Totally. Of course. It's like self-preservation at a certain point, right? Especially when your president leaves, you're like, who am I even fighting for then? You know?
Yeah. What are you fighting for?
And your ally
to lose. And why die when you,
that they didn't even want? Like that's, like that's yeah. the big thing is it's not like their idea of like a free Afghanistan and the idea that we were trying to sell them, like we were just trying to get them to buy the car without giving a shit like what they needed or what they wanted.
Yeah.
And so I think I don't think that anything could have changed that without, you know, having started over years ago. I think the only way this could have gone better is if we left after like the Tora Bora caves, like fight when we realized bin Laden wasn't in the country.
Right. But yeah. And Afghanistan was considered like the good war for all those years. Ironically, like there's a revisionist history now, I feel like, where people are saying we shouldn't have never been there.
After 9/11, we all knew we had to go in. Right.
Yeah, and everybody supported for years. And even Obama, I mentioned the surge because it was like this idea that like this is the war we're supposed to be fighting. This is where bin Laden was. Let's go and finish the job. And that's how we felt.
I mean, that's here, how but, I felt like that. Because first day of my senior year was 9/11. So I remember like kind of being like, am I going to go to college? Like, what am I going to do? And then like 25 minutes into my first day of my senior year, like that happens. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm joining the army. Wow. and kind of like figuring that out. And then you started seeing like all the stuff about like, you know, how they treat women and children and like all of the awful stuff going on with the Taliban. And I'm like, okay, like this is my chance. Like this is my like fighting the Nazis. Like this. And
yeah.
And then you get to like the villages and you see these people and like you really like share like moments of humanity with them. Like it's like the parents like seeing us hand out the gloves and then like cooperating because okay, like these people, like we just, the only thing we give a shit is keeping our kids alive and safe. And these people seem to be the ones that are helping us do that. Like that happens. But then the fucking Taliban comes in and like they took the gloves from the kids and started using them to make bombs so they didn't leave fingerprints.
Oh, and God.
So it's like, it's this thing where like the Taliban is like unquestionably evil and bad.
Yeah.
But they're just, they're too, yeah, they're too green and like they're too like, yeah, and it's just like it's too deep and it's too easy for them to like disperse. And it started like so long ago, like that they consolidated power like slowly and started saying, okay, like women can't go to school, like you have to grow this, like it didn't happen overnight. And so you start to see stuff like that happen. And it just, I'm honestly like, not to get like super political, but I'm like kind of scared of like seeing the same thing start to happen here. And that would, I feel, be like the biggest.
In what way?
So,
or what do you mean by that?
So I don't think there's like a secret that like the left and right are more at odds with each other than they've ever been.
Sure.
So you have like just some of the parallels of seeing like people going and trying to, you know, be more restrictive against women in the name of religion, kind of like the Taliban did with you know, their women, but using Islam. And you start to see like all these things like education saying like, oh, we can't, you know, we don't want you to teach history the accurate way or this or that. And it's the same things that we saw happening there. And,
wow.
And like that kind of terrifies me, because it's like at that point, you know, even if we didn't make a huge change in Afghanistan, it would feel like a bigger loss to kind of see that happen here. And like, I try not to get too political, but like, I just think there's so many correlations and like seeing the patterns, and like, that is alarming to me.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean,
I guess I have a daughter. She's going to school. She doesn't like it. She doesn't want to go to school.
She wants to be a YouTube star. So she would rather be in Afghanistan where she didn't have to go to school.
She's like, I don't have to go to school there.
This sounds great to her. Yeah. Oh my gosh. All right. Well, thanks, man. Thank you so much. I mean, I think
heavy episode.
No. I think it's just reality. I mean, we're trying to figure out how this whole thing fell in 2 days. And I think the big answer is it didn't fall in 2 days. It was,
yeah,
I didn't even know. So I'm still kind of blown away that the Taliban, even when we were there, 2008, 2009, 2010, whatever, when you were there, that the Taliban had so much control. I guess, Kaplan, you said you knew that. I didn't know that.
Well, I knew they had regions. I knew there was, and it's the fact that I didn't realize though that you said that there were regions where they had that,
like where they could control the fields and the poppy fields and everything.
Like I knew they would, there'd be bombs every once in a while you'd read about and stuff like that. Well, so I knew they weren't.
That's the thing of like the way they fought the insurgency, was it doesn't take a lot of people. Like it doesn't take much to make a region ungovernable, and like they don't have to control things and pass the laws. They just have to make sure that the effective government, like, you know, the Afghan government in this case, can't do that.
They just need like instability and chaos, kind of.
Instability and chaos. And then they can roll in the middle of the night, you know, post their notes, and then take off. And, you know, whether those threats come to fruition or not, like that power, like there's still that invisible hand saying, like making influence and stuff like that. And then you come back and you deliver on it if need be, but it doesn't, it's so much easier to be an insurgent than it is to, you know, to be an occupying army.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the thing, even if we kept a base, you know, or kept nearby, like I was saying with South Korea earlier, it's just, we, without having troops there, like on the ground, like you're saying,
to enforce things to keep the there'd be no hope for the Taliban was going to take over. Yeah, basically, it sounds like we had no way of stopping that.
Even if we were there, like
eventually,
we weren't doing a great job of identifying who was who. Like we tried, but it's not like they were wearing uniforms. Like you would sometimes see like the black head wraps and things like that. But there were also, you know, just normal people in black head wraps. And,
yeah.
And sometimes like they would disguise themselves as women because like the burqa provides a lot of like really good, like if you want to get out in a pinch, throw a burqa on, nobody can see your face.
They weren't identifying as women, you're saying? They were
disguised.
They were just disguising. And
transitioning.
And there would be a lot of stuff like that. And so it became very difficult to do that. And then also like they had the internet, they had cell phones, like and like travel, like word travels so fast there. It's like insane like how fast like word would travel. Like we would leave one village, go to another village like really fast, and they'd be like, oh yeah, I heard you like talk to like so and so. And it's like that was 10 minutes ago. Like how do you know that? Like, and it was just because like gossip travels like wildfire. And so it's you can't win it with force. You can't
win it
with might or technology or anything. Like it has to be ideological and it has to be agreed on. And that's why nobody's ever conventionally going to ever win it.
Yeah, it doesn't work. So, all right, well, let's end on this. How about your book? Tell us a little bit about the book Heist coming out in October.
Oh, yeah, awesome. Thank you. So, my book Heist comes out. It's available for pre-order now. You can just search like Barnes & Noble, Pete Stegmaier. It's going to be the first topic. But basically, it's a compendium of 100 different heists and like cons and scams throughout history. I dive pretty deep into like how they worked, the people behind them. And it was definitely super fun. It's way more of like a bedside, like, you know, read a story before bed kind of book. But it's super fun. I had a great time. And then you can also check out my podcast, which is kind of like a companion piece where I like dive deeper into each of those stories and new ones every week.
And what's the podcast called?
The podcast is called I Can Steal That.
Nice. I Can Steal That. Cool. Everybody check it out.
I love that idea. That's a great idea for the book, by the way. You can make like...
It is a great idea. How did you come up with this concept for the book? So
I got approached by a publisher. They found my podcast and said like this would be a really good book format, like would you write one? And it worked out really well because like a lot of the stuff I already had scripts for my podcast, so it was just, you know, adapting it to the new format and adding like new things and getting to like really have some fun with it.
Awesome. Cool. All right, the book is Heist, coming out in October. The podcast is I Can Steal That. Pete Stegmaier, thank you so much for doing the show, man.
Of course, thanks for having me.
Illuminating and enlightening. Kaplan, that's it. What should we do?
We need to find some publishers to come
adapt this podcast.
I think this is a great.
But in the meantime,
thanks, Pete.
There you go. You got an endorsement.
I think it's a great format that's going on the back of the book.
I think it's a great format. You get smart.
Get lost.